The largest competitors at this summer's Olympics in London are not weightlifters or shot putters or basketball centers, big as they may be. The largest competitors are horses. And in our countdown to the Olympics today, we're going to find out how these athletes travel to the Games. That is the job of Tim Duta, who does this for a living. He's on the line from a stable in Wellington, Florida. Mr. Duta, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Look forward to speaking to you.
Where are you exactly right now?
We're in Wellington, Florida, which is about 15 miles inland from Palm Beach, at the Indoor Riding Center, watching some horses exercise.
So how many horses do you need to transport from the United States or from across North America to London this summer?
I would say we expect somewhere about 50 or 60 horses, but they'll be all going in different times. Plus, we have the Paralympics, mm-hmm. so they'll be also sending their horses and para riders.
I guess if you're transporting horses from the United States to London, you can't just load them in horse trailers.
That's correct. Our company, the Duta Corporation, give horses wings. This is what we do. We've been doing it for 25 years. Most horses, I anticipate, will be going from Newark Airport in New Jersey to Stansted in England. We'll be flying them in an MD-11, and the carrier we expect is going to be Federal Express.
FedEx.
Yes, and this is an all-cargo airplane, and we should have a team veterinarian and, of course, a professional groom accompanying these horses. Coach class is 3 in a box, and business class is 2 in a box. Same service, except the seats are much more comfortable, or in this case, the pallet is much more comfortable.
So, okay, business class flights.
Yeah.
You've basically got the equivalent of a row of stalls on board the plane.
That's exactly correct.
Some hay down on the floor and everything?
They will have hay. They'll have maybe apple juice just in case they don't want to drink enough. So we mix that with water. We do Gatorade just to make sure the hydration level goes. And, of course, carrots.
Do horses get jet lag?
They do. They are animal of routine. They get fed at a certain time. They get exercised at a certain time. They wake up at a certain time. They go to sleep. What we have seen is the best performance is either a short arrival, 4 days out of competition venue, or we do a long-term staging, which is about 14 days to 21 days. So the horses, the grooms, the staff, the riders get used to the jet lag and get back into a routine.
There must have been horses over time that were extraordinarily skilled, but they just didn't travel well.
Absolutely, just like humans. Some people fall asleep just before takeoff on an airplane, and some people worry about and pray to God till they land. Most horses that travel around the world are used to it, but even though they are superstars, we do have some horses that do not like to travel, that are warriors, and we do all we can to make sure the stress level is little as possible.
Some people will, of course, take a drug of one kind or another when they're flying. Do some of the horses get drugged?
It is a call of the team veterinarian, and if they need a mild sedative, which is equivalent to, say, a glass of champagne or two on the airplane, we certainly make sure that happens. and the job of us on that call is we want to get the horses there as safely and as relaxed as possible. We dim the lights inside the cabin of the airplane. The pilots are very skilled. They understand that we have very, very expensive, precious horses on board. We sometimes reroute an airplane 1,800 miles away just to beat the weather so they don't have the transatlantic bumps. We do leave no stone unturned to get these expensive animals there as safe as possible.
Tim Duta is owner of the Duta Corporation. He joined us from a stable in Wellington, Florida. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Steve. Best to you.
Covering the world, it's Morning Edition from NPR News. You can follow us, by the way, on Facebook, Google+, and on Twitter. We're at Morning Edition and at NPR Inskeep. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
Finally, I want to play a clip from a conversation with writer Sandra Singh Low. She spoke last week on the NPR National Call-In Show Talk of the Nation about a provocative piece she had written for The Atlantic about the heavy financial and emotional cost of caring for her elderly father and stepmother. It was a pretty sobering conversation, which is what you might expect since her piece was subtitled, "Why Caring for My Aging Father Has Me Wishing He Would Die." And then Yvonne called in.
In 2000, when my mother's heart suddenly stopped, and I took care of her for 10 years, and that was total care. That means bathing, making all of her meals, changing her diapers. I also work in long-term care. I'm a registered nurse. And on top of that, my youngest daughter gave birth to a child that she really couldn't take care of herself. So I was doing, all of that.
Oh, my God.
And I got to tell you, there were times when I thought I was going to lose it. I could not. I felt so angry, and I'm ashamed of that.
Let me just say that I recognize that their stories are not the whole story. I just attended a beautiful funeral service for the father of a friend of mine, and one of the most powerful parts of the day, along with funny and heartwarming remembrances of the father, was the acknowledgement of my friend and her family for making her dad so much a part of their lives. At the funeral, my friend's husband told the story of how his wife moved her father into their home bit by bit. A piece of furniture would show up here, a suitcase there, until guess what? There was nothing left for her father to do but get comfortable and settle in. I have another friend who took an open-ended leave from her job and moved her three young children back to her childhood home and persuaded her husband to commute to his job in another city in order to see her mother through a serious illness and to help run her mother's small business until her mom could get back on her feet. And when I marveled at what she'd taken on, she told me, "When my mom's not okay, I'm not okay." Can I just tell you, that is real. But the story Sandra Singh Lowe tells in The Atlantic is also real. Her father was once so frugal, some might say mean and cheap, that he refused to turn on the heat or celebrate Christmas. But when he became infirm in his 80s, along with his dementia-suffering second wife, Sandra and her siblings saw no choice but to arrange for care topping $10,000 a month. That's on top of her father's health crises, daily phone calls demanding Viagra, and the stepmother's erratic and sometimes violent behavior. All of which leaves Sandra afraid that the final years of her father's life will leave her with nothing left to take care of herself or provide for her own children. The guilt, the anger, and the fear, this is not just her story. What's behind that fear? Demographic reality. People over the age of 85 are the country's fastest growing group, and their numbers are projected to double by the year 2035. And Singh Lowe pointed out the next wave is coming. 77 million of the youngest baby boomers will be turning 70 before the end of this decade. This is in part what underlies the churning in Washington and on the campaign trail about Medicare, Medicaid, and so-called Obamacare and Romneycare. The idea that you could do everything, quote unquote, right, save money, stay out of trouble, educate yourself and your kids, and you can still end up in a precarious and even perhaps degrading condition. But good luck trying to figure out how what they're talking about out there connects to your life or Sandra's life or her dad's or the caller Yvonne's life and her mom's. Increasingly, it seems our political leaders are talking among themselves, and we are left to commiserate and cry with each other. And that's our program for today. I'm Michelle Martin, and you've been listening to Tell Me More from NPR News. Let's talk more tomorrow.
The makers of soft drinks are under pressure to replace an additive they've used for a long time to give colas their brown coloring. NPR's Allison Aubrey reports consumer advocates have raised concerns about the safety of that additive, and now manufacturers have come up with a solution they hope will put the issue to rest.
Around the corner from Studio 3A, here in the NPR newsroom, a cubby of vending machines draws traffic 24 hours a day.
I need a drink, so there we go.
Senior editor Maria Godoy pops open a can of Coke Zero. Coke is popular here, and the way this bubbly drink gets its brown color is from a type of caramel coloring. Consumer advocate Michael Jacobson of the Center for Science and the Public Interest says a chemical in the coloring is shown to cause cancer in rodents. He says it's nothing like the caramel we'd make in our own kitchen.
It starts with sugar that's treated with ammonia under high temperatures. And that's what leads to the carcinogens. And we don't think that this should be used in the food supply.
Now, the Food and Drug Administration says we'd have to drink something like 1,000 cans of soda a day to reach the doses that appear to cause cancer in rodents. But nonetheless, last year, the state of California placed the chemical, known as 4-MI, that's found in the coloring, on a list of cancer-causing agents and told soda makers that if they didn't get most of it out of their products, they'd be required to print a cancer warning message on every can, a decision the soda industry says was ridiculous.
Caramel color is now, has always been, safe and harmless.
That's Ted Nixon. He is CEO of the world's largest manufacturer of caramel coloring. Coca-Cola is one of his clients. When California regulators made it clear that they saw the 4-MI in caramel as a problem, he says his scientists went back to the drawing board.
We did have to change these various inputs of temperature, pressure, and the various ingredients that we're using in order to change this one attribute.
So starting a few months ago in California, with no fanfare, Coca-Cola and other soda makers made the switch to this newly modified caramel coloring. Coke plans to use it nationally going forward, though they say the 4-MI in their product never posed a health or safety risk. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Let's devote the next few minutes to the subject that President Obama began his press conference on, the U.S. housing market. The president pointed out that in many ways the U.S. economy is looking up, but
there are still millions of Americans who can't find a job. There are millions more who are having a tough time making the rent or the mortgage, paying for gas or groceries. So our job in Washington isn't to sit back and do nothing, and it's certainly not to stand in the way of the recovery.
NPR's Chris Arnold joins us now to talk about just what the president is proposing to do about the housing market. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Renee.
So what jumps out to you in what the president had to say?
Well, actually, the first thing that I was struck by is that the president holds this big, you know, first press conference of the year, and there's all these big issues out there involving national security. There's Iran, there's Afghanistan, and the president opens up with talking about the housing market. And I think that may signal two things. And one is that the White House recognizes that the economy is getting better in a lot of different ways, but the housing market's not getting better, and home prices are still drifting lower, and the White House recognizes that this is, look, it's a critical issue for the economy. And number two, this appears to be a political drum that the president wants to beat going into the election. And you could hear some of that language during the press conference. We've got some tape we can play here.
I'm not one of those people who believe that we should just sit by and wait for the housing market to hit bottom. There are real things that we can do right now. It would make a substantial difference in the lives of innocent, responsible homeowners.
And when the president says he's not one of those people sitting by, I gather that's a reference to Mitt Romney.
Right. Mitt Romney said in a campaign trip to Nevada back in October that one thing you could do to help the housing market is, quote, don't try to stop the foreclosure process, let it run its course and hit the bottom. And that seems to be what the president was referring to there. And the president's trying to draw a contrast. There's been criticism of those remarks by Romney, by Democrats, the president saying, hey, I want to do something to help housing. And there's also a political calculus here as well. The housing market's been a pretty big disaster, it's fair to say, I think, on Obama's watch. Economists could argue, you know, whether that's his fault or not his fault or if he inherited it. But the reality is it doesn't look so good. And so as the rest of the economy recovers, the president may want to show that he's very focused on trying to help the housing market.
So what is the new thing that the president announced yesterday?
A couple of things. The president talked about a deal with the banks to compensate some military service members who were wrongfully foreclosed on while they were deployed overseas. And this was a scandal a while back. The banks looked terrible. I mean, these are people fighting on behalf of our country, and then the banks are improperly taking their houses. So hopefully there's some closure there, and there's supposedly some compensation there for those folks. The president also talked about the Federal Housing Administration, the FHA, and the FHA is going to be lowering fees for what are called streamlined refinances. And the hope is that that will help more people to refinance their home loans.
And that has to do with the issue that the administration and some members of Congress feel that too few Americans are able to qualify for today's record low interest rates, right, on home loans.
Yeah, and some economists and some lawmakers feel that there are upwards of 10 million Americans who should be able to qualify to refinance. They could be saving thousands of dollars, but they're blocked for various reasons. This could help some of them.
And then, Chris, new numbers out yesterday that foreclosures are on the rise again.
Yeah, and one company that tracks this says that foreclosures were up 28% in January. And quickly, what's going on there is that there was this big foreclosure settlement, this $25 billion settlement with federal and state regulators and the banks. Now that that's signed and kind of put to bed, a lot of banks had been sitting on homes, afraid to foreclose on them. Now they're moving ahead and they're starting to foreclose on a lot more people.
NPR's Chris Arnold, thanks very much.
Thanks, Renee.
And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. one of baseball's most colorful personalities, has managed teams far and wide, first across the U.S., then of late in Japan. Now Bobby Valentine has returned to America, much to commentator Frank DeFord's relief.
Coaches and managers as a group have always been pretty straightforward types. We don't think of generals or preachers as humorists. And after all, that's pretty much what coaches are, a hybrid of the military and the pulpit. But at least in the past, there were always a fair complement of coaching characters. Old Cracker Barrel philosophers, feisty wise guys, and even a few sardonic intellectuals. But the oddballs are diminishing. I think much of this has to do with the fact that sports has increasingly come to depend upon statistics. And so more and more coaches aren't skippers, as they've been colloquially in the past, but for goodness sakes, programmers. Where is Al McGuire when we need him? Abe Lemons, Duffy Doherty, Al Davis. But it's in baseball where we most miss the characters at the helm. Baseball, after all, is the national pastime. A lot of time passes in the dugout. It's the most oral of sports. Thank heavens, even if his address has changed to Miami, Ozzie Guillen is still around to shoot his mouth off in the best tradition of Casey Stengel and Earl Weaver. But all praise and glory go to the Boston Red Sox for bringing Bobby Valentine back to provide some antic charm and irritation. The irony is, too, that the faceless new Boston general manager was determined to bring in another bland button pusher, but Larry Lucchino, the club president, the same original thinker who utterly changed the whole face of baseball by championing the construction of Camden Yards in Baltimore, which thereby created the friendly modern ballpark, Lucchino pushed for articulation and pizzazz. For a man smart enough to have learned Japanese when he was managing an exile over there. So spring training has hardly started, but here we have Valentine already having fun in English, teasing, prodding, and especially nettling the pompous Yankees, stirring up the best rivalry in the sport. My goodness gracious. Bobby V even dared criticize the sainted Derek Jeter. And next, by jabbing at Alex Rodriguez, Valentine actually managed to get A-Rod to say something cute and unscripted. I have my new press secretary, Reggie Jackson, so I'll let him handle that, the erstwhile artless slugger wisecracked. With such witty repartee, for the first time I could appreciate what Cameron Diaz saw in that guy. So welcome back to baseball and byplay, Valentine San. If your team wins, fine. But it's enough to just keep talking a good game. Lord, do we need more of that in sport today.
Commentator Frank DeFord, he joins us each Wednesday.